Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
Welcome back. I'm Carrie Weber, executive editor at America, and I'm here today with Father Matt Malone, our editor-in-chief, and my fellow executive editor, Father Sam Sawyer. And we're talking about the news at the intersection of the church and the world, and we will be speaking shortly with Leah Labresco, one of our contributing editors, who went down to one of the largest parish, Catholic parish in the United States. But first, I want to talk a little bit about this article we have online. Pope Francis, the Dublin meeting will take a deep dive into Amoris Laetitia, not just Chapter 8. That's our social headline there.
Right.
We keep sort of like reading and then chuckling at our own headlines on the air, which perhaps maybe, is that good? Is that bad?
It's charming, I'm sure.
It's better than weeping at our own headlines.
That's true.
Right.
It's talking about sort of the theme for the 9th World Meeting of Families, which is going to be in Dublin, Ireland, in August of 2018. The Gospel of the Family, Joy for the World. And joy and the family is not necessarily like a new combination for Pope Francis. But he talks about, you know, that starting from love, he said, the family can manifest, spread, and regenerate God's love in the world. And I think, you know, he talks about it sort of rejuvenating the church in Ireland and elsewhere across the world. And it's a pretty standard message, but it's one that I think we need to kind of keep reminding ourselves of. I like that the church takes the time to do that.
Right.
That we're going to have this meeting of families, and, you know, families, not a new thing, but like the way we live out our family life changes a lot. It has changed, and will continue to change. And the fact that the church sort of keeps calling our attention to our families and to the importance of that basis of our society, I think is great.
This piece was reported by Jared O'Connell, who is our Vatican correspondent, and he got some really great interviews for it. One of the things that I was writing to Jerry about was, you know, how, once again, this word joy appears, right? This is a favorite word of Francis. It's my second favorite word. Hope is my favorite word. I don't know why I'm telling you this.
Despite your story the last time,
yes,
how
I know.
Nothing
just,
we do makes a difference.
Right. Well, yes, maybe there is a kind of desperate quality in my like.
But you still have hope, so that's good.
Yeah.
Do we want to get mercy in there as well?
I do.
Okay.
But I think we heard about the joy of the gospel. Here is the joy of the family. You know, giving an account of the joy that's within us is so vital to any kind of evangelization. And I was delighted that it wasn't, you know, the family in crisis or the crisis of the family. And
right.
But trying to lift people up and have an effective pastoral response and a conversation that starting point is the very joy that he has been talking about throughout this pontificate.
Right. And also, you know, as Carrie pointed out in our headline, lifting up some of the wonderful work that was done by the Synod on the Family and, you know, perhaps unfortunately submerged in the media attention over the back and forth over Chapter 8 and the question of communion for the divorced and remarried, that as important and as significant and maybe even neuralgic as it is by no means the whole story of what family means in human life or what family means in the life of the church. It's actually only the smallest part of that. And Amoris Laetitia is this beautiful document that sums up so much of what the Synod did that we really haven't had a chance, I think, as a church broadly, universally, to really receive and begin to unpack. So.
No, like when that came out, I was pregnant with my son, who folks have probably heard about online. Who's almost one now. But like, there's a section in there where Francis
and
talks about.
He was just reading a Morris Letizia.
He was reading the New Yorker recently. I have to say.
A smart Catholic baby. Yeah.
And but there's a section in there that just talks about, you know, the importance of naming a child and the fact that you get to do that as a parent and that the significance that brings and the history and the faith that you pass on through a name, perhaps. Like, there's little things that, you know, I think people I'll think about, and like, does this sound good with my last name, you know, right. Or does this, you know, sound too close to his cousin's name? When he brought a real sort of spiritual significance to that, to this gift of giving somebody part of their identity when they're born. And there's so many little gems like that in this document that people just do not get to because of that chapter 8, which I'm right. not saying shouldn't be there, but you know, that it would do us well to go back and read it again.
What is that like? To pick a name for a child, like do you and your husband, where you sit around and
yes,
kind of brainstorm names
correct.
In your living room?
Uh huh. That's
really
exactly yeah.
See how they fit together. And
that's literally what happened.
Is there an Irish baby names book?
we did look up. My husband is from Ireland, and so we did actually. We wanted like an Irishy name to represent that part of his history. My mom's whole side of the family is from Ireland, so we both have that Irish heritage. And the name we chose in the end was Killian because it means associated with the church. And we loved that about it. We were like, all right, that seems appropriate for him, for us.
And you're pretty churchy people.
We tend to be sort of at the church a lot and the intersection of the church and the world. And we like that. We like that it had the Irish aspect of it. We did spell it the Irish way, which has caused us insurmountable amounts of grief, I think, but it's C-I-L-L-I-A-N. We should have known that people would say Cillian all the time, but good old Killian.
He'll have fun in elementary school.
Years and years of correcting people ahead of him. Right now, they also think he's a girl. I'm not sure. I think because it rhymes with Jillian and Lillian.
Oh.
So if they don't, yeah, so.
Oh, interesting.
So Francis didn't mention any of these little snares in his document. Like, fine.
It might be in one of the footnotes.
Yeah.
And is he the only Killian in your parish? Or is Killian a popular name right now?
As far as I know, he's the only Killian other than the one Killian that we know all that works at our office as a consultant, who we hired right after I chose Killian, my son's name, thereby making him somewhat less unique in our world, but it still works.
I know. And when this consultant came back and I said, you know, just so you know, when you propose your fees, just remember that Carrie named her baby after you.
Yeah, that's part of your payment. That's how effective his consulting was.
Right, exactly.
It's changed us forever.
Speaking of parishes, our contributing editor, Leah Labresco, has visited the largest parish in the United States of America, which is an extraordinary thing, and has a piece at americamagazine.org called Lessons on Evangelization from the Largest Parish in the United States. And Leah joins us now. Nice to have you with us, Leah.
Thanks for having me on.
So what is the largest parish in the United States like?
Well, daunting, really.
Yeah.
Even just approaching it from the street, it's on a little rise over the streets, and there's, you know, enough trees to be a small forest surrounding it. And when I approached to just find people to interview, I was having trouble trying to guess which building I was supposed to walk towards. And I'll say that, you know, there's a sprawling campus with the gym that has masses, the actual church that has masses, all this meeting space for the ministries, and this is one of their two campuses.
It's basically, it's almost like a college.
It reminded me a lot of a college.
And now, where is it? Tell us
this
that.
This is St. Matthew's in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Why is it so big?
Part of the reason it's so big is that Charlotte itself has gotten a lot bigger in recent right. years. So as the city's grown, so too has the number of Catholics in the city, and they've grown a little faster than a diocese can keep up with. Especially a diocese that was used to having way fewer Catholics. Less than 1% of Charlotte was Catholic in the 80s, and now it's up to 10%.
Wow.
So as they've grown, they've kind of relied a lot on the diocese they had to be able to expand and keep accommodating people rather than plant new dioceses all the time.
Mm. Well, and as you point out, I mean, some of these numbers are really staggering. First of all, at one point, 8 people named Pat worked there. But 30 years ago, the parish had 237 registered families, and now serves over 10,000 registered households. And according to the research, the median Catholic church in America has 761 registered families. They had 600 to 700 children receive their first communion in a single weekend, over four masses. They have up to 21 extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion lined up at numbered stations during Mass, and 7,000 volunteers run 103 active ministries.
And when you're picturing that's what it is today, you should know that what it started as, if you're picturing like a small hardscrabble church, you're still wrong. It started in a movie theater. They'd borrow a movie theater on Sunday when the church began.
Wow.
To meet, and they just put out on the marquee, you know, Mass as one of the attractions at the theater.
Starring Jesus.
And they still have a popcorn machine at the parish just as an homage to their beginnings. But it's really been an extraordinary growth, and they've had to change a lot of the ways they run things compared to how a parish usually approaches it to accommodate that growth.
So how does that, what does that look like?
They've only got four priests.
That's crazy. Right?
Right. Like if you picture 10, the way
families and four priests.
Parishes with two priests often feel a little overwhelmed. I think what's really happened then as a result is that the priests I spoke to said they mostly focus on the sacraments. They focus on what only a priest can do for the community. And a lot of everything else winds up lay led. So, you know, all parishes mostly often have a DRE, a director of religious education, who's managing things, but here, you know, it's like managing a school. You know, it's not a couple classes a week. It's a terrifying number of catechists. Just the act of scheduling everyone into slots.
592, I believe, is the number
right.
You said
and
in the article.
And if you picture how long it would take you just to call 592 people to confirm they're on for this year.
Well, whether or not you could know their names, I mean, at that point.
Well, that's something Pat, who runs the religious education program, says has been one of the Pats. says has been kind of a harder thing for her as the church has grown, because she used to know every single catechist.
Right.
And practically speaking, she can't. She knows people who know every catechist, and that's kind of her check, and she checks everyone out. But, you know, there's something always sadder about being in charge of lots of people who you don't know.
Now, one of the things, and you look into this in the article, that St. Matthew's has adopted to attempt to kind of deal with this fact that the parish, you know, at scale is very big and can maybe even get a little impersonal sometimes, are small faith sharing groups where they're actually learning from non-Catholic models there. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, a whole group from St. Matthew's actually took a trip to Saddleback, a huge evangelical mega parish, because they figured...
The Rick Warren Church.
Exactly. Yeah. And they figured whether or not they share things doctrinally, they might be able to learn some stuff just about their logistics. One of the things, you know, they've tried to do is have a lot of small groups that meet outside of church, so you're talking about the faith and kind of being heard by other people and being seen and known by other people in the parish in the context of your faith life. One of the things that's harder for them, they thought, than it is for Saddleback, is that at Saddleback, you know, there isn't the Mass. So what people kind of get is material to discuss for the week when they gather together on Sunday and they're sent out to discuss it. For a Catholic parish, if you want to give people something specific to discuss beyond the homily, something that's not as targeted to the scripture readings for the week, you have to find a different avenue to communicate it, because, of course, we have something much better to give at Mass, and it's Christ himself. But they kind of left them with a challenge in adapting that model.
I mean, it seems to me that we have a lot that we can learn from those mega churches. I visited one once, and which I won't name here on the air, but it was a very nice experience. But I wanted to see it. I wanted to see how it worked and you know, how they organized these masses of people. This was in an old sports arena that had been converted to one of the, you know, huge churches. And the thing that impressed me the most was the hospitality. You know, and the moment that I entered, people came and greeted me and welcomed me and, you know, introduced themselves and showed me where the area was for new people who came and so forth. And I would imagine that kind of hospitality is crucially important when you have that size of a community, right? Because you could very easily just get lost in all that.
And St. Matthew's tries to do that not just when you enter the building, but they have specific hospitality ministries to welcome new parishioners for a while after they've joined. So it's not just that each time you turn up, you see a friendly face, but you can meet with a bunch of other new families, talk about how you're registering your kids in school, talk about just moving stresses, talk about trying to find a place in the parish. And I think, honestly, the most striking thing about what parishes can learn from giant parishes, evangelical or Catholic, is that lots of the accommodations we think of as being necessary for a huge parish are necessary for a lot of medium-sized parishes, too. That many of the best things I saw at St. Matthew's, you know, maybe were easier to do because they had so many people to draw on to do them, but were a really good idea for a medium-sized parish.
Right.
Oh, that makes a lot. So what would one of those things be that could be sort of scaled down to a regular size parish?
I think the welcoming ministry is one of the most obvious, just because, you know, it's a really critical time for anyone joining your community who's already in some kind of state of flux if they've just joined a new church. And it's reasonable to assume that those folks need more help and to try and make sure that they really do find friends. I've been really lucky because in my life, I'm a convert. So a lot of people kind of did for me what St. Matthew's does for new people because they knew I was a new Catholic. I had a priest aggressively, like, friendship matchmake me. He told me what parish to go to in D.C. He's like, you'll go to St. Peter on the Hill and you'll meet Sarah and she'll be your friend, you know, and I'll email her to tell her that, right? And she was, and I loved her. But if you don't have someone looking out for you when you enter, it's much harder, and it's a shame to go to Mass week after week, you know, just you. And the liturgy, which is beautiful, but as though you were attending a private Mass somewhere.
Right.
Yeah, because I imagine it could be hard for people who enter the church. And if you enter in the group of catechists, catechumens, kind of feeling a part of something and then sort of being thrown out into the deep and not really being sure of where to go.
Well, and catechumens get mystagogy, right? We make sure we take care of people for the whole Easter season after they're brought into the church in RCIA. But for people who are joining the church who are already Catholic, folks just still need love and companionship. You know, that's not something that's unique to converts. It's just the nature of being human.
Well, and I've actually, you know, I've had experience at a number of parishes where people hang on to the RCIA experience precisely because it offers them this kind of small group, this parish within a parish, a place where they can actually share their faith and be known. But as you point out, that should inspire in us the question, well, okay, so how do we do this more broadly than just within that context? If this is a need people have, we should be looking for ways to meet it.
One of the things that would be hardest to adapt downscaling from St. Matthew's is just the tremendous variety of communities they can have. They have a pinochle club. and, you know, what they do is everything they do is supposed to involve social service and spiritual. So the pinochle club plays pinochle, prays at their meetings, and brings muffins for the muffin rota, which go in the muffin refrigerator that they have marked.
A dedicated refrigerator
for muffins? I saw it in there. It says muffins only. And I may not be the only muffin refrigerator because they distribute them as part of their food ministry. But so groups that kind of don't have an intrinsic service component are called on to participate in one of the other service components.
I really liked that when I was reading your piece because I thought it just was so dynamic in terms of connecting people and connecting people back to the faith that it's not, you're not joining the parish just for the social aspect either. You're not there to like get some friends and find a babysitter and go home. You're there to be more fully integrated into your faith and your community.
And I think that's something you can imitate at a much smaller scale, not even of your parish, but of your social life yourself. Because, you know, I get together with Catholic friends and then don't by default pray with them except right as we eat. And one thing my husband and I have been trying to do is just to pray more often when we're with other Christians, whatever the reason it is that brought us together.
Right.
So we had a Shakespeare marathon and we announced like the marathon will start at 11, morning office will start at 10:30. Like anyone who wants to show up early, show up for morning office. But I think we all have that opportunity and St. Matthew's does a nice job institutionalizing that part.
You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel Sirius XM 129. We are speaking with our contributing editor, Leah Labresco, about the muffin refrigerator at St. Matthew's Parish in Charlotte, North Carolina. And other things. And you can actually find her article called Lessons on Evangelization from the Largest Parish in the United States at www.americamagazine.org.
So we were talking a little bit about trying to get to know people at the parish. And obviously, you can't know everybody there. It would be very difficult. But the parish seems interested in wanting to know more about what everyone at the parish is thinking. And one of the ways in which they try to get at this information is through surveys. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, they partner with two different groups to try and take the temperature of the parish. They partner with Gallup, which has a religious surveying arm in addition to the news surveys you may be more used to.
Right.
And, you know, that Gallup survey is customized for Catholic churches in general, but isn't particular to St. Matt specifically. And it gives them kind of a sense of whether people feel engaged, which people or which groups of people might feel less seen or known at the church, whether they feel good about their spiritual life. And then they also partner with CARA, the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate. You know, and CARA is a specifically Catholic statistics group, and they're great. And they do a lot of work with St. Matt's, particularly trying to craft, you know, something that's going to check in on the more detailed stuff that Gallup doesn't cover. And they kind of rotate these two surveys back and forth. So they tend to survey their parishioners every year in pew. Not every single year, but usually about every year. And they distribute the surveys in the pew, and then they check out the responses when they come back. And they try and use that to guide their decision-making a little, to make sure, especially they're hearing from people who aren't the kind of folks who call up the church office to say, there isn't enough parking at this enormous church, which I was told was one of the most frequent complaints.
Oh, I would imagine. that's the worst.
Yeah, one of the examples you give in the article is that one of the things they measure is engagement, which I kind of chuckled at because it's something we measure on Facebook, but I hadn't thought about measuring it at the level of a parish. But they measured engagement, and when they saw that there was that young adults were not as engaged, that inspired a different kind of investment from them in outreach to young adults and new families. And,
well, it's funny because, of course, I'm a math nerd, so I'm walking around the parish going, tell me more about these statistics. Like, what do you do based on? They go, well, you know, you should meet the guy we hired purely because of these surveys. They realized they needed more than just a volunteer worker on young adults. So instead, they hired a full-time worker to focus on that. And I actually saw one of his first efforts. He was putting together a group for young families after Mass once a month. And I attended the second ever meeting of this group, which is one of the new things they've been able to try and take on to serve this group that seemed underengaged on the verge of possibly leaving the church.
What is the most innovative thing that they're doing there?
Well, I can tell you my favorite thing.
Okay.
You know, it doesn't sound maybe that wildly innovative, but I think it's under-practiced. They have this incredible bereavement ministry. And I think, you know, it was my favorite thing because it makes such good use of their economies of scale that they had to kind of recognize this enormous need. They have 1 to 2 funerals a week at the parish. Because it's so large, you have kind of the actuarial reality that they'll lose more people every day, just in pure numbers, than another smaller parish might. And it means that, you know, death is really just not treated by this parish as an aberration, you know, and as all Christians should think of it. You know, death is something we spend our whole lives preparing for and preparing to die, you know, God willing, in a state of grace. But because it's so powerfully brought home to them by the frequency with which they have to prepare for funerals, they've set up this bereavement ministry where, you know, if you want at the parish, they're going to help you set everything up, help you plan the funeral, you know. They have a well-oiled machine. They'll cater the funeral. The volunteers will, other families. And then afterwards, they can pair you with someone else in the parish to just meet with, you know, every week, every month for a bit, to accompanying you through the grieving process, that it's not at the end of the funeral, like, we finished here.
Right.
And I thought that was just lovely. And I thought, you know, that was one of the most amazing economies of scale of such a large parish, that, you know, the reality of human life and death, from baptism, you know, to funerals, can never be treated as something unusual. That, you know, oh, this week we have a funeral. It's like, yes, every day people die, and our job as a church is to prepare them for that moment, and God willing, for union with Christ at the end of it.
It really takes that particular work of mercy to heart, that burying the dead. I think when you think of the works of mercy, you know, in Matthew 25, that's one that sort of feels like it's not particularly achievable, in the sense, you know, people think literally of, like, I must bury the dead, like, you know, do I have to start digging graves? But I think this aspect of accompanying people in their grief is just a really beautiful way of living that out, and bringing that mercy to moments when people might otherwise feel totally alone.
And it's the work of mercy that, again, should be least alien towards us, because some people are born into and sustained in comfort and don't worry as much about food or water or clothing or shelter. Many people are not imprisoned, so they think of that as a ministry you offer to other people and might remain aloof from yourself your whole life. No one has the luxury of thinking that the work of mercy of burying the dead won't at some point be applicable to them, not just at their own death, but when they lose people they love.
Right.
And I guess I've never visited a parish where front and center the way they dealt with funerals was presented to me in that way.
Right.
The other thing I found fascinating about that is that, as you mentioned, none of what they're doing here is radically innovative. Like the idea that, you know, you would help a family plan the funeral liturgy and that you would then, at that funeral liturgy, offer to put the food together and make sure that the family's okay afterwards and keep reaching out to them. These are all the kinds of things that neighborhoods and friends would be and have been doing forever. But Charlotte's also, you know, one of the reasons the church grew so fast down there is because as industries and companies were relocating, Catholic families from the Northeast ended up moving farther down south, and all of a sudden there's a whole bunch more Catholics than you ever had before, but not in neighborhoods, or not in neighborhoods that they were originally rooted in. And it strikes me that one of the things St. Matt's has figured out how to do is to kind of rebuild a part of that neighborhood experience, but within the context of this now novel mega parish.
And they have a community that's very hungry for it, who can't be complacent about what exists around them because many of them have moved here recently. And I think that is, you know, again, where their need is a gift to the parish,
right?
Because they know their need and they bring it to the parish. I think a lot of people might belong to parishes where it feels like they're the only one who has this need of being included and being welcome and being a little uncertain in the city. And in Charlotte, they know that's not true. And in most parishes, it's not true. Many of us are all blow-ins, to use the Irish phrase for Carrie. But I think it's easy to feel alone and lonely in that need and to hide it. And because everyone knows everyone's recently moved here in Charlotte, there's less pressure to hide what's a very common need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also think that one of the things that it helped me to understand is that the reality of parish life is very different in different parts of the country. I suppose that's an obvious thing to say, but it's, I grew up in Massachusetts. I live and work in the Northeast, and the reality of the urban parish is a lot of them are struggling, and they don't see their numbers in the pews and all the rest. And so for me to go to a place like Houston and see that they can't build parishes fast enough, and they don't have enough parking spaces, right? I remember once seeing Cardinal DiNardo in Houston, and I asked him, what is the greatest challenge you face right now? And he said, parking. He said, I don't have enough parking spaces, right? It's really interesting to see that, that life is happening, right? And it's precisely the same thing. It's these shifting demographics, people coming from the Northeast and to the South and Southwest.
And folks in my own Northeast shouldn't feel too dispirited by the fact that their parishes are sometimes the wrong size for their community. One thing I found really interesting looking at the Kara-sponsored book, Catholic Parishes of the 21st Century, is just that you build churches for the community that exists at the time you built them. And it's very hard for the church because buildings don't alter very easily. So most people attend a parish that kind of was built to serve people 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 100 years ago. And America's so much noisier and more fast-moving than that. So some parishes just wind up a bad match for their community, not through any fault on either side, because it's hard to move infrastructure fast enough to keep up with a changing demographic.
Right.
Did it ever feel too big?
I mean, for me, yes. I wouldn't seek out a parish of that size. I think that it kind of gives you the big gift of having a lot of shared needs, and I thought that was the most beautiful thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it also forces you to make a lot of liturgical compromises, like the dozens of ministers of extraordinary communion, and just the fact that they have to think so much about the pace of the Mass when you have that many people.
Right.
I prefer to go to parishes that are smaller, that can, you know, linger as much as they want to without having that multiplication scale of anything that takes a second takes 2,000 seconds.
And right. You've got to clear out the parking lot or else there will
exactly.
be even more not enough parking right. spaces than we already have.
Yeah. And is there a sense of, that it could one day be too big? I mean, it's continuing to grow, right? So at what point do they say, oh, this has now taken over all of Charlotte?
It's definitely continuing to grow. I mean, I think the interesting point is that they've already passed one inflection point that you could wonder, was that the moment? Right. They have an entire separate campus miles away. Right. Like, should that have been a separate campus? Is the point where they have five separate campuses, like two at large? But I think that's the kind of largest shift in the identity of the parish, to have two churches under one parish like that.
But then they avoid duplicating things as well, right? So in some
that's
ways,
what I said
it's
is the big advantage
resources.
Of it, you know, that you have a lot of highly trained people who can take on that additional thing without without the archdiocese having to reach out for a new great DRE and so on. Right. But I think that's kind of one of the most startling changes. So if they already have that model of church planting, essentially, I don't know how large they might feel comfortable getting before the parish itself feels, the parish leadership feels it's too large.
Well, and this is actually something that in many, you know, northeastern and urban settings, the church is experiencing in reverse as we're doing this parish clustering arrangement to try to sort of achieve those economies of scale by being backed into them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the real question is, do they have pancake breakfasts after Mass, as they did at my parish growing up? And if so, how many pancakes do they need to make?
Oh my gosh, I can't imagine.
We know they have muffins.
I mean, to be clear, I went to their basement where they store a lot of stuff. I went, wow, you have a warehouse down here. And they go, no, our warehouse is a separate site. And I'm like, what? They go, it has a forklift. I'm like, what?
A forklift?
They have a forklift. They're a church that needs a forklift.
Wow. Wow.
I bet the priests aren't licensed to drive it, Matt.
Right.
But they might let you if you went down there.
Lift high the cross with a forklift. Wow, that's extraordinary. I mean, the other thing that I really like about it, we have, I guess, about a minute left, is the fact that what lay folks can do, they are doing, right? Because it has to be that way, right? And so there's a part of the a kind of operational rethinking going on of the relationship between the clerics and the lady, and that's probably healthy, I think.
I think there's a gift but also a sacrifice that in parishes that rely more on consecrated religious, you have them in front of you as an example and help people consider vocations as a nun or as a monk. And I think in a parish where you don't have those folks serving in that way, people miss the chance to wonder, wait, is that supposed to be me in that habit?
Right, right.
But they also do have an example of someone who might be a married vocation or a single vocation, and people who say, hey, that can be me too.
I just think in the secular world, we run into a lot of examples of married folks, and it's easy to go your life without meeting a nun.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it's
if you grow up in Western Massachusetts in an Irish Catholic household with an aunt for a nun, I might have a different perspective.
That's a
I think.
Great lesson.
I think I have not had a lacking of nuns in my life, so I may be lacking that perspective.
Right. Well, Massachusetts is well represented on this panel every week. The piece is called "Lessons on Evangelization from the Largest Parish in the United States" by Leah Labresco, who is contributing editor for America Magazine, and can be found at americamagazine.org. Leah, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Father Sam, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to have you. And Carrie, lovely to see you.
As always, Father Mavalone.
And say hi to Killian for me.
I will, the consultant and the baby.
Right,
I'll give
exactly.
them both your best.
You've been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. To learn more about this story and all the stories that we talked about today, you can go to americamagazine.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. And to subscribe to America, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Carrie Weber, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.